From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The U.S. military command, working closely with the Iraqi government and the U.S. embassy, has sought non-traditional means to provide accurate information to the Iraqi people in the face of aggressive campaign of disinformation. Yet this has been portrayed as inappropriate. For example, the allegations of someone in the military hiring a contractor and the contractor allegedly paying someone to print a story, a truth, but paying to print a story.
The Pentagon defends its policy of paying Iraqi news organizations to publish pro-American articles secretly written by the U.S. military. Its contractor, the Lincoln Group, is being paid over $100 million to write and plant stories. Today, PSYOPs and the war over hearts and minds. But first, was an Exxon-funded nonprofit responsible for getting the IRS to audit Greenpeace? We'll speak with the Wall Street Journal reporter who broke the story and the head of Greenpeace USA.
Greenpeace in the U.S. was audited. It just came through it with flying colors. But the important story is how Greenpeace got audited. And the group that asked for Greenpeace to be audited, being almost exclusively funded by ExxonMobil, an organization that Greenpeace has pointed out as the number one climate criminal in the world.
And hundreds of thousands take to the streets of France. We'll get the latest on the mass protests. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The recently freed kidnapped members of the Christian peacemaker teams are enjoying their first full day of freedom and preparing to head home. On Thursday, British, U.S., and Canadian troops raided a home in Baghdad and found the three peace activists. The men, Norman Kember of Britain and Canadians James Loney and Harmeet Singh Sudan, were alone in a house and reportedly in good condition. It was only after their release the men learned that their colleague, Tom Fox, had been killed 2 weeks earlier. The four men were kidnapped together in November. Following their release, the Christian Peacemaker Team organization vowed to stay in Iraq and continue their efforts in helping the families of jailed Iraqis. In a statement, the group said, quote, "During these past months, we've tasted of the pain that has been the daily bread of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. We renew our commitment to work for an end to the war and the occupation of Iraq." Officials estimate an average of 30 Iraqis are kidnapped every day. In other news from Iraq, at least 80 people have died over the past 2 days in a series of drive-by shootings, roadside bombings, and executions. In one of the deadliest attacks, a suicide bomber blew himself up outside the major crimes unit of the Interior Ministry, killing 25 people. Meanwhile, to the west of Baghdad, over 1,000 U.S. troops have surrounded a village near Abu Ghraib. After the town was cordoned off, U.S. soldiers conducted house-to-house searches and rounded up the entire adult male population of the town. Soldiers handcuffed and then interrogated every man in the village. After questioning, each man was marked with an X on the back of his neck. One U.S. colonel defended the operation, saying, quote, "What we're doing is building a Michelin guide to the area," unquote. In Los Angeles, protest organizers are predicting as many as 500,000 people will demonstrate Saturday against a new anti-immigrant law being considered by Congress. The House of Representatives has approved legislation that would criminalize 11 million undocumented immigrants and make it a crime for priests, nuns, health care workers, and other social workers to offer them help. The Senate's considering similar legislation. The National Immigration Forum has described the bill as the most restrictive immigration legislation in 70 years. The bill has generated mass opposition from immigrant communities around the country. On Thursday in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, as many as 30,000 people took part in a march entitled A Day Without Latinos. It was the city's biggest protest in years. Dozens of Latino businesses shut down for the protest. In Chicago, as many as 300,000 people filled the streets in protest 2 weeks ago. In news on Sudan, for the first time, a U.S. mutual fund firm is backing a campaign to divest from companies doing businesses in Sudan because of the government's role in the genocide in the Darfur region. The mutual fund, Citizens Advisors, said it'll ask every company within its portfolio to review and divest from investments in Sudan. According to the Sudan Divestment Campaign, U.S. public pension funds have about $91 billion invested in companies with business activities in Sudan. Meanwhile, Harvard University announced Thursday Thursday it's divesting from the Chinese oil company Sinopec because it does work in Sudan. Students at Harvard are now pressuring the school to divest from all companies working with the Sudanese government, a move taken last week by the University of California after a student campaign there. In South Korea, a woman's been selected to become the country's first female prime minister. Han Myung-suk is a former political dissident who was jailed for 2 years for opposing South Korea's military dictatorship in the 70s and 80s. She's known as the godmother of South Korean feminism. In Belarus, police have arrested hundreds of anti-government protesters early this morning following nearly a week of demonstrations over the disputed re-election of President Alexander Lukashenko. The police, wearing black helmets and masks, carried out the mass arrests at 3 a.m. after surrounding October Square, where protesters have been camped out since Sunday. International observers have said the recent election was neither free nor fair. The U.S. has called for a new vote. In South Dakota, the leader of the Oglala Sioux tribe on the Pine Ridge Reservation has reportedly announced plans to allow Planned Parenthood to open a clinic on the reservation in defiance of the state's new ban on abortion. Cecilia Fire Thunder, who's a former nurse, said the clinic will be allowed to open because the state has no jurisdiction over tribal lands. Puerto Rico's Justice Department has sued U.S. federal authorities for obstructing an investigation into the FBI's killing of Puerto Rican independence activist Filiberto Ojeda Rios. The lawsuit names both FBI Director Robert Mueller, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, as well as federal officials in Puerto Rico. In Ecuador, indigenous activists have temporarily suspended protests against the Free Trade Area of the Americas. On Thursday, police fired tear gas at hundreds of students and indigenous protesters during a march on the government palace in Quito. On Tuesday, the government declared a state of emergency in four areas, giving the police and military power to ban public gatherings and make arrests. Indigenous activists say the demonstrations are being temporarily halted after 11 days to allow the protesters to regroup and to give them a chance to plan new actions with great radicalism. This is Alexandra Meida of the Ecuadorian group Ecological Action.
Las movilizaciones que se están dando en Ecuador son protagonizadas principalmente por el movimiento indígena. Las comunidades indígenas se han...
The mobilization in Ecuador principally involves the indigenous movement. The indigenous communities have mobilized themselves in the places in which they live. In the different provinces of the country, they have shut down the highways and have blocked the transportation of resources to the cities. This is the form of protest that is occurring. The government has responded by militarizing these zones. The soldiers and the police are completely armed. They are strongly suppressing the indigenous population.
Alexandra Meida of Ecological Action. And a dean at Harvard University and a professor at the University of Chicago are coming under intense criticism for publishing an academic critique of the pro-Israeli lobby in Washington. The paper charges the United States has willingly set aside its own accuracy, security, and that many of its allies in order to advance the interests of Israel. In addition, the study accuses the pro-Israel lobby, particularly AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, of manipulating the U.S. media, policing academia, and silencing critics of Israel by labeling them as anti-Semitic. The study also examines the role played by the pro-Israel neoconservatives in the lead-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The authors of the study, Stephen Walt, a dean at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and John Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago, are now themselves being accused of anti-Semitism. In Washington, Democratic Congressmember Elliot Engel of New York described the professors as, quote, dishonest so-called intellectuals and anti-Semites. Harvard professor Ruth Wiss called for the paper to be withdrawn. Harvard law professor Alan Dershowitz described the study as trash that could have been written by neo-Nazi David Duke. The New York Sun reports Harvard has received several calls from pro-Israel donors expressing concern about the paper. Harvard Margaret has already taken steps to distance itself from the report. Earlier this week, it removed the logo of the Kennedy School of Government from the paper and added a new disclaimer to the study. The 81-page report was originally published on Harvard's website, and an edited version appeared in the London Review of Books. The controversy comes less than a year after Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz attempted to block the publication of Norman Finkelstein's book Beyond Chutzpah on the misuse of antisemitism and the abuse of history. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to our listeners. The Wall Street Journal revealed this week a watchdog group was responsible for getting the IRS to audit the environmental organization Greenpeace 2 years ago. Two years ago, the little-known public interest watchdog group claimed or challenged Greenpeace's tax-exempt status and accused the group of money laundering and other crimes. According to the Journal, tax records show more than 95% of the funding of Public Interest Watch was provided by the oil giant ExxonMobil. On its website, Public Interest Watch says it was founded in response to growing misuse of charitable funds by nonprofit organizations and the lack of effort by government agencies to deal with the problem. The group describes its mission as, quote, keeping an eye on the self-appointed guardians of the public interest.
Greenpeace, meanwhile, has been one of ExxonMobil's fiercest critics. The group has protested ExxonMobil's meetings and company gatherings, as well as its oil tankers and filling stations. Greenpeace has labeled ExxonMobil the number one climate criminal over its environmental practices. Joining us to discuss the story is Steve Steklow, senior special writer at the Wall Street Journal. He wrote the piece about Exxon's funding of Public Interest Watch. Speaking to us from Boston, also in Washington, D.C. studio, John Passacantando, executive director of Greenpeace USA. Representatives from ExxonMobil declined to appear on Democracy Now! A spokesperson said the company had nothing further to say on the topic besides what they said in the Wall Street Journal. Public Interest Watch did not respond to our interview request. Let's begin with Steve Steklow. Why don't you lay out the story?
Well, basically, a couple of years ago, this fairly little-known organization called Public Interest Watch started attacking a number of nonprofits and challenging their tax-exempt status. And their main target was Greenpeace. And they wrote a letter to the Internal Revenue Service accusing Greenpeace of literally money laundering and crimes and quite serious allegations. And then I got a tip a few months ago that Greenpeace had, in fact, been audited, and I started looking into it, and I discovered this connection with Public Interest Watch and their calls for the audit, and did some checking on their tax records, their tax records. They have never disclosed where they received their funding from, but it turns out that a year ago they filed tax records with the Internal Revenue Service, which showed that in 2003-2004 they received virtually all their money from ExxonMobil. So anyway, I started doing some checking and did a story on that. Again, this comes against a backdrop where a number of conservative groups have been attacking nonprofits and NGOs over their tax-exempt status. There have been hearings on Capitol Hill. There have been a number of conservative groups in Washington who've been quite critical. So that's the backdrop of this.
And John Passacantando, when did the IRS first approach Greenpeace about the audit, and how did you know about the connection between them and this watchdog group?
Well, we didn't know fully the connection until Steve from the Wall Street Journal called us, interviewing us about the story. But we got notified by the IRS this past December that we were to be audited. Several years prior is when we saw that Public Interest Watch report making all these erroneous claims about money laundering, very extreme charges, with no factual basis for it. It was clearly propaganda. Nevertheless, this report was moved around mostly, I have to say, the Murdoch media chain. We were getting calls from reporters, but always linked to some kind of Murdoch operation. And we would explain. We would say, come in, look at the books. We can show you that this is completely erroneous. and you would have journalists who weren't interested in looking at the books. They weren't interested in refuting the claims in this report. So the report went out, and it went into what some would call sort of the right-wing echo chamber, and it bounced around the world, never, honestly, in a reputable publication. We stayed on it. We always had, willing to counter the charges. Then we got some calls from a subcommittee to the House Ways and Means Committee saying they wanted to look into this more carefully. And we gave them, and now that committee was willing to look at the further information. We gave them full disclosure. They came no further. And then this past December, we got the letter from the IRS saying we were indeed being audited, and the IRS was in our offices for 3 months. I mean, it's important to know that we came out of this with flying colors. Greenpeace, in the auditor's words, and I have to say I think it's inappropriate the way the IRS came in, but then the audit was done professionally, and the auditor told me this is as clean an operation as I've been in. You guys were transparent and forthcoming, and you should be proud of the way you keep your books.
How did the IRS come in when you say it was inappropriate, just in terms of what sparked this whole audit?
Yes, you know, my opening question to the auditor was, were we a random selection? If we're a random selection, that's appropriate then. That's the way the IRS should work. There should be that level of scrutiny, but the IRS should not be a tool of the government to silence its critics. The government meaning the Bush administration and ExxonMobil, who have been tied at the hip in denying, refuting the reality of global warming. Greenpeace has been countering that, been pushing hard on that. ExxonMobil and the Bush administration have been the real gridlock on action to stop global warming. So when the auditor came in, one of the very first things he said was, he looked at a picture that we had of a peaceful protest at an Exxon station, where our people were occupying an Exxon station, and he said, "This illegal activity has got to stop." And I said, in fact, there is a long precedent of nonprofits using a small amount of their resources to do peaceful activities such as this, from Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement right up through Randall Robinson's and Trans-Africa work. And I said, I don't think you have your facts right, but we'll give you all the information you need. And, of course, we came out of this with flying colors, but the auditor did tell us at the end that the IRS was ultimately responding to this report from Public Interest Watch. In other words, it was a political audit. He said this was indeed a political audit. The lawyers that we worked with to get through this audit told us this has not been happening until the Bush years. The political referrals were not being listened to at the IRS, that indeed they are now. So this is a resurgence of this kind of activity, not seen since Richard Nixon was using the IRS to audit his enemies list.
Well, Steve Steklow, I'd like to ask you, the writer at the Wall Street Journal who broke this story, clearly there has been more public concern or attention around these types of audits. Obviously, the NAACP had a much publicized interaction with the IRS as well. Who runs Public Interest Watch, and what are the other kinds of organizations that they have attempted to raise concerns about?
Well, Public Interest Watch was founded by a guy named Michael Hardiman, who I interviewed, and he's a Washington-based lobbyist. He's a Republican. He's worked for he's lobbied on behalf of a number of organizations, including the American Conservative Union and the American Trucking Association. He started the organization in 2002, but it didn't seem to really gain steam until 2003 when, you know, the records show he started to get a lot of money, you know, almost all of it from ExxonMobil. In fairness, they didn't simply go after Greenpeace. They went after a number of groups, and some of them wouldn't, they included, for example, the American Heart Association. But he did go after a number of environmental groups, and one of them was a group down in North Carolina called Dogwood Alliance. They also called for an IRS audit of Dogwood Alliance, questioning its tax-exempt status. And the head of that organization told me that, in fact, they too were audited back in 2004. And once again, the IRS found that there weren't problems enough to merit taking away their tax-exempt status. They also went after a few others, but again, of the there were at least two that became were audited. Now, whether the IRS, in fact, audited Dogwood Alliance, the person there believes that, that it was because of Public Interest Watch. However, she said that the unlike in the Greenpeace case, the auditor said who was there, who was local, said he didn't know what had prompted the audit, but they're convinced. And after I talked to Hardiman, he claimed credit for it. Although I have to say, when I first interviewed him, he was not aware that the IRS, in fact, had audited either Greenpeace or Dogwood Alliance, and seemed a little surprised. But then when I spoke with him a second time, seemed quite proud of the fact and said it showed what great work he did.
I wanted to turn to John Pascatando, head of Greenpeace USA, and read an excerpt of a piece that came out last year in Mother Jones magazine by Chris Mooney called Some Like It Hot. It's about some 40 public policy groups that have this in common. They seek to undermine the scientific consensus that humans are causing the Earth to overheat, and they all get money from ExxonMobil. And Chris Mooney writes... Mother Jones has tallied some 40 ExxonMobil-funded groups that either have sought to undermine mainstream scientific findings on global climate change or have maintained affiliations with a small group of skeptic scientists who continue to do so. Beyond think tanks, the count also includes quasi-journalistic outlets like TechCentral.com, a website providing, quote, news analysis, research, and commentary that received $95,000 from ExxonMobil in 2003, a FoxNews.com columnist, and even religious and civil rights groups. In total, the groups received more than $8 million between 2000 and 2003. ExxonMobil chair and CEO Lee Raymond serves as vice chair of the board of trustees for AEI, that's American Enterprise Institute, which received $960,000 in funding from ExxonMobil. The AEI Brookings Institution Joint Center for Regulatory Studies, which officially hosted writer Michael Crichton, received another $55,000. When asked about the event, the center's executive director, Robert Hahn, who's a fellow with the AEI, defended it, saying climate science is a field in which reasonable experts can disagree. By contrast, on the day of the event, the Brookings Institution posted a scathing critique of Crichton's book, State of Fear. Can you talk about the power of ExxonMobil? And I have to say, I wish they were joining us to talk themselves.
Yes, well, and the reason they're not joining us is their power has been behind the scenes. Their power has been to keep their name off of things, but fund a whole range of groups that literally go out there and deceive the public in the name and use names like Public Interest Watch or some kind of independent think tank. They are Exxon tools. They're funded by Exxon to do Exxon's bidding, which is to continue to confuse the public. In their knowledge of the enormity of what's coming on us on global warming. I believe that when we're past this era and we are indeed reorienting our economy to stop global warming, when we ask why did we wait so long, what was the reason for the delay, we will know that it was ExxonMobil that held the world back. What Greenpeace's main role in this, in addition to our protests of ExxonMobil around the world, we built a database to delineate all the money that we could find from ExxonMobil to these groups that are essentially out there lying about global warming. And we put it all online. It's called ExxonSecrets.org. And it's essentially a website for researchers. And all our documentation is on it. So people can look at it and then go actually find the hard copies of this data and prove it to themselves. Exxon has intentionally spent millions of dollars to deceive the public, to lure us into this complacency so we wouldn't worry about global warming, all in order to protect their short-term oil profits. Meanwhile, this storm of damages from global warming is building in strength, and we have an administration and a Congress that have looked the other way and have been able to sort of count on a confused American public, and that has been the tragedy of this.
Exxon, of course, can afford to spend that money, having just recently reported $36 billion in profit last year, the greatest profit of any corporation in the history of the world, and a sum larger than the budgets of 123 countries in the world. Your organization has continued to have a major confrontations or criticism of ExxonMobil, obviously, over the years. What was the latest in terms of your organization's having to deal with them?
Well, what we've continued to do is expose them. When people have leaked us papers, there have been a number of times we have continued to show this link between ExxonMobil and the misinformation in the news. There was an employee at the Council on Environmental Quality who was editing one of the EPA officials, career official Rick Piltz, who was writing about global warming in a required report coming out of the Bush administration, coming out of our government, and this fella, Phil Cooney, was editing out all the references to global warming and softening everything. This was revealed, this was broken on 60 Minutes this past Sunday evening. This particular fellow worked for the American Petroleum Institute before he went into the Bush administration. And then when he got caught red-handed editing out this global warming reality from this government report, he was then hired by ExxonMobil. So we spend a lot of time tracking these people, who they are, where they've come from, where they've gone, and all roads do lead to ExxonMobil.
Interesting. Also, Mother Jones in that piece reported that less than a month after President Bush took office, an ExxonMobil lobbyist named Randy Rendall sent a memo suggesting certain climate experts from the Clinton administration should be, quote, removed from their positions of influence. A year later, the Bush administration blocked one of the scientists, Robert Watson, from his post at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. What's that, John?
Our point is that ExxonMobil has played an unbelievably aggressive role. Many of the other big oil companies have backed off of this, don't want their integrity impugned by getting involved in this kind of nefarious work, of essentially lying to the public. ExxonMobil has had a very strong hand in this and has worked very closely with this White House to continue to confuse the American public so it can continue to stall actions to stop global warming.
Well, we want to thank you both very much for being with us, John Passacantando, head of Greenpeace USA in Washington, and Steve Steklo, senior special writer with the Wall Street Journal. We will link to the piece on our website, democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
ABC, NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news,
faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
I worked at ABC News, worked at CNN.
To see so many colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration.
Thank you, sir.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
All the networks wanted to have was a countdown to war.
Overemphasis. Overkill.
48 hours to war. Dun, 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 dun. Showdown to Saddam.
The purpose of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Mr. Secretary.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, that polarity, media wars. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said Thursday the Pentagon will review whether it is proper for the military to pay Iraqi organizations to publish pro-American articles secretly written by U.S. forces. Earlier in the day, Marine Corps General Peter Pace, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, called for a formal review of the policy and said that the military should disclose when it pays for a story. He said, quote, "The worst thing you can have is people feeling like somehow they've been snookered." Last November, the Los Angeles Times first revealed that the U.S. military was secretly planting stories in the Iraqi press. Articles written by U.S. military information operations are translated into Arabic and then placed in Iraqi newspapers with the help of Washington-based defense contractor, the Lincoln Group. The articles are presented to an Iraqi audience as unbiased news accounts written by independent journalists. The Lincoln Group's contract is worth up to $100 million over 5 years.
When the secret propaganda program was first revealed, even the White House admitted it was, quote, very concerned about the practice. But earlier this month, the top Pentagon brass insisted it'll go on. General George Casey said an internal review of the program had, quote, found that we were operating within our authorities and responsibilities. Pentagon officials told the New York Times this week the Lincoln Group remains under contract and will continue its activities unless the military revises its policies. In February, Rumsfeld gave a major address on information warfare at the Council on Foreign Relations. In it, Rumsfeld criticized the media's coverage of the Iraq War and defended the military practice of planting stories.
In Iraq, for example, the U.S. Military Command, working closely with the Iraqi government and the U.S. Embassy, has sought non-traditional means to provide accurate information to the Iraqi people in the face of aggressive campaign of disinformation. Yet this has been portrayed as inappropriate. For example, the allegations of someone in the military hiring a contractor and the contractor allegedly paying someone to print a story, a true story, but paying to print a story. For example, the resulting explosion of critical press stories then causes everything, all activity, all initiative to stop, just frozen. Even worse, it leads to a chilling effect for those who are asked to serve in the military public affairs field. The conclusion to be drawn, logically, for anyone in the military who is asked to do something involving public affairs, is that there is no tolerance for innovation, much less for human error, that could conceivably be seized upon by a press that seems to demand perfection from the government, but does not apply the same standard to the enemy, or even sometimes to themselves. Consider for a moment the vast quantity of column inches and hours of television devoted to the allegations of unauthorized detainee mistreatment. Some additional photographs have come out just this week. This, of course, was an event where the policy of the president and the policy of the government was for humane treatment and was against torture. And there were some people on a night shift who engaged in mistreatment of detainees. So this week, again, out of Australia, I guess, some same pictures, similar pictures, same event, of people on the night shift, one night shift in Iraq who did some things that they have since been punished for and under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. But weigh the numbers of column inches and hours of television involving that event, for example, against the discovery of Saddam Hussein's mass graves, which were filled with literally hundreds of thousands of human beings, innocent Iraqis who were killed. That's the reality of the world in which we must operate and in which our forces are fighting. The terrorists are trained. We've seen the so-called Manchester Manual. They're trained to lie. They're trained to allege that they've been tortured. They're trained to put out misinformation, and they're very good at it.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld went on to stress the importance of information warfare.
We are fighting a battle where the survival of our free way of life is at stake, and the center of gravity of that struggle is not simply on the battlefields overseas. It's a test of wills, and it will be won or lost with our publics and with the publics of other nations. We'll need to do all we can to attract supporters to our efforts and to correct the lies that are being told, which so damage our country, and which are repeated and repeated and repeated.
For more on the story, we're joined by Andrew Buncombe, Washington correspondent for the London Independent, who's covered the Lincoln Group and the military practice of planting news stories. He's joining us in Washington, D.C. And on the phone from Virginia, we're joined by Sam Gardner, a retired Air Force colonel. He has taught strategy and military operations at the National War College, Air War College, and Naval War College. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Andrew Buncombe, we begin with you. Tell us about the Lincoln Group. Who started it? Who pays for it?
The Lincoln Group remains to this day a somewhat mysterious and hidden group based here in Washington. They were set up 5 or 6 years ago, essentially, by a young British guy called Christian Bailey. That wasn't his first name. His first name was Christian Yosefovitz. He changed his name whilst he was at university at Oxford. And since then, it seems his career has been one of shifting and moving and perhaps not being as forthcoming about the truth as one would hope. He's only a young chap. He's 30, 31. He's got no experience in public relations, and yet last summer he landed a $100 million contract for planting faux news stories, should we say, within the Iraqi media. These weren't technically false stories. They were technically true, but they portrayed an inaccurate and imbalanced picture of what's going on in Iraq. Essentially bribes, because Iraqi journalists were being paid vast amounts of money, relatively vast amounts of money, to put these stories in, essentially out of the control of their editors.
So how does a young person with no experience, even in the public relations field, manage to land a $100 million contract?
I think they call it networking. And as you probably know, Washington's the prime city for networking. What Mr. Bailey assiduously did since arriving in the U.S. in the late 90s, first in San Francisco and then in New York and then in D.C., he very meticulously developed a network of contacts, up-and-coming young professionals, mostly linked to the Republican Party. He courted them assiduously. A very charming young man, from all accounts. And he saw an opportunity. He made a partnership with a former Marine, a guy called Paige Craig, who took care of the Iraqi end of the business. And in the aftermath of the invasion, back in the spring of 2003, they leapt on an opportunity to go and make their fortune, as many other companies across the U.S. and Britain have done, the spoils of the war.
Now, he also claims to have as a partner in his company a group called WCV3 Security. Could you tell us about them?
Well, if you look on their website, they list a number of groups and people and individuals who they say have been partners with them and have helped them over the years. A lot of those people have since pointed out that their partnership with Mr. Bailey and the Lincoln Group have been all but fleeting, have since ceased and never really amounted to much. The one group you mentioned is a consulting firm out in Northern Virginia. One of their senior executives was involved in the attempt during the last election. You remember back in the summer of 2004. I think it was August. The Swift Boat affair that was one of the things that severely damaged John Kerry's campaign. That was the group of veterans which essentially portrayed a false picture of John Kerry's war record and questioned his claims about his service in Vietnam and the Cambodian border. That involved one of this group's chief executives who took unpaid leave to go and work on that project.
And that project, of course, was Stolen Honor, the famous film that was aired around the country.
That's absolutely right.
Aimed at discrediting John Kerry. Andrew Buncombe with us, Washington correspondent for the London Independent. Also, Colonel Sam Gardner on the line with us, retired Air Force colonel who is very familiar with PSYOPs, with psychological operations. Can you respond to the Pentagon saying the Lincoln Group is doing a good job, even if right now General Peter Pace is saying they're going to review further what the Pentagon is doing, the whole issue of planting stories?
Sure, Amy. If I had to sort of divide, I would say they're doing some good things, but they're doing bad things. And it may be the bad things come from their lack of experience or this attitude that seems to exist within the Department of Defense that the story is more important than what you do, which seems to dominate it. The good things, I mean, they're doing sort of typical psychological operations stuff. For example, they printed for the Marine Corps labels that went on water bottles that they handed to pilgrims in Iraq, and the label said, if you see a terrorist, please call this phone number. Now, that's not bad. That's good psychological operations. It doesn't destroy democracy. It doesn't destroy the faith of the people. That's the kind of thing that they ought to be doing. But when you begin to gosh, when I hear the Secretary of Defense talk about this, I worry that he doesn't really want to defend democracy because he doesn't trust it. And that is when you have to make up stories to sell the thing that you're trying to defend, you've gone down a bad road. And that seems to be what he talks about, and that seems to be what part of what we're seeing from the Lincoln Group. Now, the good news is that you mentioned is I think General Pace, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said, and probably upset the Secretary of Defense, that I'm sort of paraphrasing him now. I'm not sure this makes sense when we do this kind of thing. Good on him. This is the second or third time that he stood up to the Secretary of Defense. The other thing that Rumsfeld said in that piece that you quoted, he sort of, in his mind, he mixed public affairs and psychological operations. Public affairs is what the Pentagon tells us. Psychological operations is what they tell the enemy. The former chief of staff, General Myers, was very concerned that these were coming together, like it sounded as if Secretary Rumsfeld wanted them to. They have to be separated, or we end up with a situation where the people who are supposed to be making democracy work don't have the truth to deal with, and then we've got real problems.
But there is this other area, not of what, as you say, public relations that they tell us or psychological operations against the enemy, but the public that surrounds, let's say, an insurgent force. And there's been a long history within the United States government of trying to influence public opinion through, quote, legitimate press. I remember the studies written about in Guatemala how the CIA in the run-up to the 1954 coup against Arbenz planted numerous stories in the Guatemalan press to sort of prepare public opinion for it. And most recently, it was revealed in papers of the COINTELPRO FBI operations in Puerto Rico how the FBI regularly wrote and planted and got editors of legitimate newspapers to plant stories against the independence movement. So there's been somewhat of a history of our government, unfortunately, resorting to using legitimate press to sort of shape public opinion.
Right, Juan. And you probably had to mention the CIA and most of those. There is a law which forbids the government to plant false stories in American press. The problem with technology is it's now no longer possible to separate those. So we get false stories that are planted overseas. But let me just use an example in the early part of the Gulf War. About day one in the Gulf II, the Pentagon reported, and it was reported in Doha, that the 51st Division, which was the division that Iraq had defending down there, had surrendered in total. The commander and all the people had surrendered. Now, that was put in because the military wanted the people of Iraq to believe that the fighting was going very much on our side and the units were disintegrating. That was not true. And the British ended up fighting this 51st Division in Basra for almost a week afterwards. It's a good psychological operations technique to say that to the military in Iraq, but with current technologies, that was said to the American people. And it was not true. It was a lie. And that's where the psychological operations and the public affairs have become mixed. And, it's hard to tell, you know, when we're getting the truth and when we're not.
We're talking to Colonel Sam Gardner, who's very experienced in the whole issue of PSYOP, psychological operations, and Andrew Buncombe of The Independent. Andrew, when the whole operation takes place in Iraq, the planting of these stories, can you tell us about the process, the storyboards, how Iraqi journalists get these stories, the Pentagon writers who write them?
Yeah, I can tell you something. I can't tell you everything. The reason being that the Pentagon refuses to reveal its hand in this still. I spent some time trying to obtain examples of the stories that were being printed That was refused on the basis that this investigation was still ongoing. Perhaps now that it's been concluded, we'll see what they were actually doing. But there were a number of ways. The stories were written by American troops, the Joint Psychological Operations Command. I'm sure the colonel can correct me if I've got that wrong. But they're British troops who are trained to do this stuff. And they were either paid for or they were provided to editors through go-betweens in Iraq. Very often, Iraqi editors didn't require payment. They were happy just to print stuff to fill their pages. In other cases, they were paid up, you know, $1,000 to pay them. What they also did, however, was that they courted local Iraqi journalists, correspondents, reporters. They established a so-called Baghdad Press Club, something which never previously existed, but a system whereby journalists would be invited to attend a Lincoln Group facility, and they'd be given money or gifts to go back to their offices and say they had these stories. Now, I spoke to some Iraqi newspaper editors who said, who were trying to essentially professionalize the journalism post Saddam Hussein, and they said there was no way they could compete with this because in one morning an Iraqi journalist would be sort of receding from the Lincoln Group a month's wages. Now, how do you deal with that if you're an editor? How do you say, well, you know, that's not the sort of thing we want, when you can't check your sources for every story that every reporter brings in, and you're relying a lot on trust. And if you're an Iraqi journalist, why would you necessarily think anything wrong was happening if you didn't know this was being done by the military? Remember, of course, the U.S. military hid its hand in all of this. It didn't come out and say this is being done by the U.S. military. That's what the Lincoln Group was there for. Indeed, they hid their hand. And, you know, let's be honest, if you're being given a month's salary for a morning's work and you've got a family, and given the chaos and violence and madness that is the current situation in Iraq, who would not be tempted to take that money and to run with the story?
We just have 30 seconds, but Colonel Sam Gardner, you referred to a law, the Smith-Mundt Act, that prevents the propaganda, the government, from putting it out in this country, but it can be done internationally. Now, with the global media, with the internet, would you venture to speculate if some of this that they say is directed the Iraqi population is actually the main point is to have it recycled back into the United States as a PSYOPs operation right here at home?
Well, the Secretary of Defense told us he wanted to do that, and he was going to do that when he started out with his strategic influence group. Now, that still exists, and it has been transferred down to the contracting unit that contracted with the Lincoln Group, which is the Special Operations Command, and they have worldwide responsibilities. And I think it certainly exists and is part of what's been making up the story.
We want to thank you both for being with us. We certainly will continue to follow these stories, these planted stories. Colonel Sam Gardner, retired Air Force colonel, taught strategy and military operations at various military colleges here in this country. And Andrew Buncombe, Washington correspondent for the London Independent. And we will link to Andrew's piece on our website at democracynow.org. As we turn now to France in a minute. Brothers here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to France. Students and union groups across the country have taken to the streets to oppose a law that makes it easier for employers to fire young workers. Nationwide demonstrations continued for a fourth day on Thursday, drawing between 220,000 and 450,000 people. In the latest unrest, police clashed with protesters in a central Paris neighborhood. Police said they made 420 arrests. The clashes left burned cars, smashed store windows, and injuries on both sides of the barricades. Meanwhile, a demonstrator remains in a coma after sustaining critical injuries at a protest last Saturday. Witnesses said the man, Cyril Ferrez, was beaten viciously by police. A photo taken of the incident shows Ferrez lying on the ground before he is swarmed by police. The police were also accused of refusing to call the paramedics as he lay bleeding and unconscious. The law in question is called the First Job Contract Law. It allows employers to fire workers under the age of 26 years old for any reason during a two-year trial period without having to offer an explanation or give prior warning. France's parliament approved it 2 weeks ago without any debate. The law awaits final approval from France's Constitutional Council before coming into effect. Students have joined forces with teachers, workers, retirees, opposition politicians, and labor union leaders to oppose the law. Recent polls show at least 68% of the public are against it. In an apparent concession to the protesters, the government will open talks with union representatives today, but there is no indication the government will back down from its staunch defense of the law. The unions refuse to negotiate until the law is withdrawn and say they will only use the talks to press demands. They called for a nationwide strike next week. Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin addressed the issue in front of Parliament on Wednesday.
Je veux le redire. Je veux le redire devant la représentation nationale.
I want to say it again in front of the representatives of the nation. What drives us is the will to arrive to concrete, efficient, and fair action for the young people and their future.
Et juste pour les jeunes, pour leur avenir.
To open up for them the doors of employment and success in our society.
Dans notre société.
Joining us are two people who've been in the midst of the protests. Jade Lingard joins us on the line from Paris. She's a journalist who covers politics and social movements in France. Also with us from Paris is Jennifer Hamm. She's a student of philosophy and sociology at the Sorbonne, taking part in several of the protests. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Well, the protests at the Sorbonne led to the police raiding the university for the first time in a very long time. Jennifer Hamm, why did the students take over the university there?
Hi. First of all, I think it was very pacifist. We wanted to talk, and we had a lot of debates for many, many hours. We wanted to open the university and make it a place more lively and eventually discuss about the CPO in a good condition. So the occupation started on the 8th of March and ended up on Saturday morning when we got evicted at 4 a.m. Obviously, I think that everybody was really shocked to hear that news because the eviction was quite violent. There was a lot of tear gas used inside of the Sorbonne, and you could smell it down to Saint-Michel, so that's a couple of blocks away. I think that the movement just keeps on increasing a lot since that event and during the riots that took place, because riots take place in front of the Sorbonne almost every day, but especially 2 weeks and a week, the last week, sorry. Many students and policemen are injured, and I think being evicted from the Sorbonne has not helped the situation to improve at all.
Jade Lingard, would like to welcome you to Democracy Now!
Yeah, hi.
Could you tell us, in terms of putting these protests in context, it's been probably going back to 1968 since France has been rocked by this kind of massive protest, or have there been others in recent years?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because there are similarities with May 68, obviously the youth movements, obviously the students, obviously the Sorbonne events. But what happens is that it's really different when you look at it closely. And one of the main differences is that in 68, the students wanted in their revolutionary dream to join in with the workers. And what happens today is that many of these students are now workers also. They have to work to pay for their studies. And this is a major change in the sociology of the students here. Their struggle now, this fight, is extremely political, and it's really interesting to see that it goes far beyond the opposition to this contract, even though this contract triggered the movements and demonstrations, but it's going far beyond that, and it's massively a demand for more social justice against inequities and against the attitude of a government which has been so far extremely reluctant to discussion and social dialogue.
Mm-mm. Why is the Prime Minister pushing this so hard?
Well, you know, in 1995, we had another right-wing prime minister, and he was extremely contested on the streets about his reform, about social security. And for weeks and weeks, you've had demonstrations, unions joining in together, which is not so common in France. And he tried to hold on up onto his positions as long as possible, and he eventually lost. Apparently, Dominique de Villepin is trying to do better than this prime minister in 95, but apparently is going to have to retrieve his contract. You know, here nobody see what other way out other than retrieving the contract. And right now, the unions are meeting with him at Hotel Matignon, at his office. And what everybody expects now is to see how they're going to reform and change deeply this contract.
Jennifer Hamm, I'd like to ask you, it was only a few months ago that France was rocked by protests by Islamic and Arab youths around the country. Is there any indication that some of those protests also have had an impact on the students in their willingness to take to the streets in the last month?
I don't know if it really had an impact, but the riots in the suburbs just turned off in a way because of winter. And there's still anger you can sense in the suburbs now. And now that it's springtime, people are starting to wake up again in a sense. I think that makes sense. But in the same time, something Villepin said a week ago, he said that the CPE doesn't concern the university students. But I had a lot of interesting talks and debates with friends in university. And I think this, what Villepin said, saying, okay, this doesn't concern you, just makes it makes us even angrier to see that the youth is being divided into different categories. It's like there's an effort to build a sort of under-proletarian class. For example, people who live in suburbs, there's about 40% of unemployment over there. And I don't think that it's a good reason to say that, not a good reason, but it's a good thing to say that it doesn't concern us. It does concern us.
Jennifer Hamm, at that point, we have to leave it there, but we will continue to follow what is happening in Paris and all over France. Jennifer Hamm, student at the Sorbonne, Jade Lingard, journalist covering politics and social movements in France. And that does it for today's broadcast. Tonight, I'll be at the Virginia Festival of the Book at University of Virginia in Charlottesville at McLeod Hall Auditorium at 7 o'clock. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock here in New York at the Rutherford Place off of 15th Street. At the Quaker House, Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshoof, Abdul Kadush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate, Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin, Megan Whitney, and Samantha Chamblay. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.